Welcome to the 432nd meeting of the Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations, both to our members and guests who are here today and to our radio audience reaching us through the stations of Maine Public Radio. Today's meeting comes to you from the Elk Events Center in Rockland, Maine. I'm George Look, president of the forum. The forum was founded in 1983 as a citizens' forum for study and discussion of the development, formulation, and implementation of U.S. foreign policies and the factors influencing them. We are now entering our 37th year of forum meetings to hear an invited expert from the world of international relations, journalism, or academia talk about critical U.S. foreign policy issues and answer questions from our members and guests, many of whom are experts in their own right. Details about and audios of past forum talks, upcoming forum programs, and how to become a forum member are available on our website at midcoastforum.org. We are very pleased today to have with us Professor Paul Majewski, who will be speaking on Maine and Arctic climate change. Dr. Paul Majewski is director of the Climate Change Institute and distinguished professor in the School of Earth and Climate Sciences, School of Marine Sciences, School of Policy and International Affairs, the Center for Ocean and Coastal Law, and the Business School at the University of Maine. Professor Majewski has led almost 60 expeditions to some of the most remote polar and high altitude reaches on the planet, including the polar regions, Greenland, the Himalayas, Tibet, the Andes, and sub-Antarctic islands. He has more than 430 scientific publications and has received numerous honors, including the first internationally awarded Medal for Excellence in Antarctic Research and the Explorers Club's Lowell Thomas Medal. He holds an honorary PhD from Stockholm University, is an honorary fellow of the American Polar Society, and a fellow in the American Geophysical Union, American Association for the Advancement of Science, Explorers Club. He developed and led major international and national climate change research programs in Antarctica, Greenland, Asia, and New England. He has worked with outreach entities such as the American Museum of Natural History and the Boston Museum of Science. Dr. Majewski has released two popular books, The Ice Chronicles, The Quest to Understand Global Climate Change, published in 2002, a little bit ahead of his time, or at least ahead of where we are today, and Journey into Climate, Adventure, the Golden Age of Climate Research, and the Unmasking of Human Innocence, published in 2011. He has appeared hundreds of times in the media, including multiple times on CBS's 60 Minutes, several Nova films, numerous national public radio pieces, and in the 2014 Emmy Award-winning series, Years of Living Dangerously. Paul, it's a pleasure to have you here, and welcome to the Midcoast Forum.
Thank you very much, George. Can everybody hear this right now? Works well? Great, thank you. Well, what an absolute pleasure it is to be here. Thank you so much for coming, and I look forward to hearing your questions and being able to speak to many of you. I know you come with a tremendous amount of expertise yourself, so I look forward to learning from you too. Let me just restart this. Sorry, take 1 second. There we go. Okay, I'll be talking about Maine and the global climate system. And in order to be able to describe what's going on in Maine in the latter half of the presentation, it's important to have some sort of perspective. And as T.S. Eliot told us many, many years ago, sometimes you need to go quite far away in order to understand what's going on at home. And that's certainly been the case with climate change. If we take a look at records, in this particular case, this is an ice core, something that we specialize in recovery of. This one comes from Antarctica. It's probably one of the most famous modern climate records. It shows the evolution of CO2, carbon dioxide, over the last 850,000 years. And the most striking thing about this record is the fact that the levels of CO2 have risen 1.5 times above what we have experienced in the last 150,000 years, only in the last few decades. And if you convert that into speed, turns out that greenhouse gases like CO2 have risen 100 times faster in the last few decades than they have at any time in the last 850,000 years. That's a very important statement because it means that suddenly we have taken a mechanism by which the climate normally changes, greenhouse gas rise, and effectively put it on speed. And that's what's happening today with the results. So I've led expeditions all over the world trying to understand how the climate has changed. And glaciers themselves actually turn out to be one of the best indicators. They integrate weather and climate over many years, and when they get smaller, it's telling you it's getting warmer or perhaps less precipitation. And in fact, some of the earliest understanding of climate change came from looking at glaciers and realizing that they're getting smaller. They are getting, in the mountain areas of the world, smaller almost to the last glacier. There are a few that are getting larger, but there's been a dramatic change. And these ice cores allow us to go back hundreds of thousands of years. They allow us also to look at events storm by storm, even 50 or 100,000 years ago. And we can use these ice cores to understand past temperature, precipitation, atmospheric circulation patterns, levels of pollutants in the atmosphere, biological activity, sea ice extent, volcanic activity. It goes on and on. They're truly robust records. In the late 1980s to the early 1990s, I had the great pleasure and honor of leading 25 U.S. institutions in a program that successfully recovered an ice core from the center of Greenland. And that ice core provided us with, year by year, a 110,000-year-long record. It was the first continuous record of its type. And it allowed us to understand how the climate system changes under natural conditions, which is why we know that CO2 is important, and also come up with an understanding of how things like CO2 have changed. The most important thing that we learned from that study, and it's been verified several other ways right now, is that the climate system does not operate slowly. It was always assumed prior to about 1992, when our work came out, that the climate system took hundreds, if not thousands, of years to change. If that had been true, or if it were to be true, it really wouldn't matter how much CO2 you put in the atmosphere because the change would take forever. What we discovered was that in less than 1 to 5 years, you could find dramatic changes in temperature, precipitation, atmospheric circulation patterns, and once that change occurred, the system could stay set in that new equilibrium for many decades, if not hundreds of years. At the time, it was really an academic finding. We didn't necessarily understand why this would have great application, other than the fact that the climate can change faster than a political cycle, which is obviously pretty fast. One of the things, as we started applying this abrupt climate change understanding, one of the things that we learned was that it, in fact, in certain parts of the world, and obviously the climate impacts in different parts of the world are different. Sometimes it's an increase in temperature, a decrease in temperature. Sometimes it's getting drier, wetter. But some of these changes are so dramatic that they actually led to the collapse of civilizations. One of the most dramatic was 4,200 years ago, the collapse of the Mesopotamian Empire, which is modern-day Syria and Iraq. And within a matter of 5 to 10 years, basically, their civilization, their cities were built just on the edge of a desert. The desert invaded them because of climate change, and that was the end. They were totally dependent on water, obviously, as we are today. The collapse of the Mayan Empire in South America, exactly the same thing, a very rapid change produced because of a shift in the winds that produce and bring precipitation in. In AD 1400, after the Norse had spent close to 400 years living on the coast of Greenland, particularly the west coast of Greenland, all of a sudden it got 1 degree centigrade colder, not very much, and sea ice began to lock Greenland in, and the Norse could no longer get their yearly supplies from Scandinavia. And as a result, because they never adapted to the local culture and understanding, they disappeared completely. So warming, greenhouse gases, abrupt climate change, these are all things that can have very dramatic impacts, as we're obviously learning today. But the evolution of warming is really a little bit different than what we might think about. After all, we tend to call it global warming. The assumption would be that the entire planet is warming, and it will eventually. But right now, we've had dramatic warming in some parts of the world, not so much in other parts of the world. And we'll focus primarily on the Northern Hemisphere. The redder the color, the greater the warming. And that red-colored area is the Arctic Ocean, or I should say Arctic sea ice. It is now a new ocean. What a remarkable situation to realize that there is a new ocean emerging, which was, based on everything we understand, we're the first humans, perhaps, to actually experience this new ocean. Interestingly enough, it was assumed that it would, that the sea ice would disappear. And in about probably the middle 2005 or so, there was some indication that this was going to happen. The estimate was that the sea ice in the Arctic during the summer would largely disappear by 2040. Then the estimate was 2025. And then in about 2012, they said it would be 2015, and it happened that year. So things are happening much faster than we thought, and this is truly an amazing abrupt climate change that we have just experienced in the Arctic, and it impacts the entire Northern Hemisphere, and I'll talk about also how it impacts Maine. In the eastern Arctic, in the Russian Arctic, this temperature change was about 1 degree centigrade per year for a five-year period. This was the warmest part of the Arctic, and if you translate into something that makes a little bit more sense, is a bit more tangible, it's equivalent to doubling the length of the summer. It's had very severe impacts on the local people who live in the area, and by looking at the ice core record, we can demonstrate that this change that just happened between 2007 and 2012 in the Arctic is equivalent in magnitude and in speed to the change that happened between the transition between the vestiges of the last ice age and modern climate 11,500 years ago. And that was a dramatic change. It led to the beginning of humans beginning to go from being hunter-gatherers to agricultural activity. These changes in the temperature of the polar regions in particular have had dramatic impacts on atmospheric circulation patterns. And this particular animation shows you the edge of the jet stream. And when the jet stream tends to go pretty much west to east, that means that the Arctic is relatively cold compared to, for example, to today. And the jet stream is the dividing line between the Arctic polar cold regions and the regions to the south. As the Arctic warms, and it has significantly, obviously, the dividing line becomes much wavier, as you see in this, I'll do it over again here, in this animation. And as a consequence, warm air masses can be pushed much farther north, and cold air masses can be pushed much farther south. And the net result, when you have more air, more cold and warm air coming together, ends up making a stormier situation and a variety of other very extreme events. So there is no doubt whatsoever, if you remember only one thing about this presentation, the new norm is considerably more instability in the climate system, largely generated by this waviness in the shape of the jet stream. And if we look at one of the extreme events, as of about 2014, in the middle of winter at the North Pole, when it's absolutely dark, the temperature is, every now and then, above freezing. An absolutely remarkable thing when you think about it. Not sure what Santa Claus does. And in this, if you go to the western side of the United States, as we all know, there were very, very disastrous wildfires in California. California's had wildfires forever, but the frequency and the magnitude of these wildfires is increasing dramatically, and much of it has to do with the jet stream. As the jet stream begins to come down on the western side of the Rockies, because the shape of the jet stream is always changing, and the more elongated it gets, the longer it takes for that in this particular case, cold air tongue to be transmitted eastward with the winds. As that jet stream comes down on the western side of the Rockies, it drags warm, dry air on one side of it into California, and the winds are very strong too. So these are perfect conditions for drying out the forest and obviously intensifying the forest as a consequence of increased oxygen and winds. So where air masses go is extremely important, and our air masses are moving around in much less stable pattern than they have in the past. These air masses are important because they result in cold and or warm air. We all know, living in Maine, if the air comes from the south, it's warmer. They result in wet and dry conditions. They transport pollutants all over the planet, and they have an impact on surface ocean currents and the way surface water flows. So if we understand more about atmospheric circulation patterns, how they will change in the future, we have a much better understanding of making predictions for the future. And our institute, which is made up of about 140 people, we're one of the oldest, and not the oldest, multidisciplinary climate research units in the world. We're dedicated to understanding past climate, modern climate, in order to make better predictions for future climate. So physical aspects of the climate system are not the entire story. Temperature, precipitation is not everything. We're also interested in understanding how pollutants in the atmosphere have changed and how humans have impacted this. If you remember back in the 1980s, in particular in the 1990s, the big question was acid rain. Is acid rain caused by humans or not? So we were supported at that time by EPA. We went to Greenland to be able to demonstrate that whether or not acid rain, sulfuric and nitric acid, were actually related to emissions from North America and from Europe. And the answer was unequivocally yes. We could demonstrate this by going back to the pre-industrial period and then showing the rise. And that was very interesting. It had something to do with the renewal of the Clean Air Act. But I think what was even more important is it demonstrated that legislation at the federal level can be very effective. These glaciers capture everything that's in the atmosphere. And when you clean the atmosphere, you can see it immediately. You have absolute proof. And if you begin to look at all of the things that we've put into the atmosphere, I like to call these the undeniable human impacts. It's not only greenhouse gases, which obviously stay in the system for hundreds and thousands of years, but it's acid rain, toxic metals, various organic pollutants, radioactivity, all of these things. In the last 100 to 200 years, we've created an air quality situation in over our planet, which is unparalleled, not in the last 850,000 years, but unparalleled actually in Earth history. And it has a lot to do with the way we and the ecosystem evolve. If you put all of these things together, this is maybe the most depressing slide. It actually gets a little bit better after this. No, it gets better. Particularly living in Maine, it gets better. You put all these things together and you basically have a toxic climate cocktail. In the case of warming, it's bringing vector-borne diseases into Maine and other parts of the planet, creating drought, flood, as I just mentioned briefly, respiratory disease, small particles. In this country, in general, we have relatively safe air quality, but the standards for small particles are often exceeded. And these get into the small bits of your lungs, creating problems. Neurological diseases, cancer. These are all as a consequence of lead levels in the atmosphere, cadmium levels, which tend to be on the slightly unsafe side in many parts of this country, are directly related to airborne versions of cadmium, directly related to autism in infants. And then when you think about ecosystem upheaval, ocean acidification, invasive species, et cetera, this really is a recipe for not very good things. If you take a look at the importance of air quality worldwide, 1 in 10 people die as a consequence of poor air quality. That's about 7 million people per year. So when you think about all of the despair that's associated with this, and also the tremendous health costs that are associated with it, it's a very important issue. One of the most encouraging things, however, is the fact that you can clean the atmosphere up very rapidly. Not with respect to greenhouse gases. They mix in the atmosphere and they take a long time to go through the system. But things like lead in the atmosphere, arsenic, cadmium, mercury, all of these can drop out very quickly. And we found that out, unfortunately, in 9/11, when the aircraft was shut down over the United States and people didn't drive around as much. It was probably the cleanest that air quality had been in many decades. So it's nice to know that we can actually clean the system up of some of these super toxic substances that fast. So though there are many things that we're not doing a good job about with respect to cleaning up the atmosphere, there are some that we are, and more legislation would certainly help. But the wild card that appears in terms of warming is methane in the Arctic. And as sea ice disappears from the Arctic, as the permafrost, which holds tremendous amount of organic material in it, begins to disappear, methane gets released. And methane is 30 to 50 times more effective in trapping heat than CO2. So we will see a very major abrupt climate change once we get to the right level of methane. And figuring out what that is of course, a grand challenge. So now let's, with this sort of general understanding of how air quality and physical characteristics of the climate system operate globally, most importantly, the impact of the Arctic and the fact that it's changing the climate through the jet stream over the entire Northern Hemisphere, let's talk about Maine and what's going on in Maine very briefly. In order to do that, our institutes put out several reports. The second most recent came out in 2015. It's called Maine's Climate Future, and I'll use some of the information from that report. It's available on our website. You just go to Climate Change Institute and you can find it. And the one that we put out most recently in 2019 is called Coastal Maine Climate Futures. This is a report that really focuses on the changes that are occurring along the coast of Maine and also describes what some of the impacts are on various industries. And I'll talk a little bit about that. Maine is an amazing place. We are obviously the size of the rest of northern New England and bits of southern New England, but that's not very big compared to a lot of places. But we do have a tremendous diversity of climate. The state of Maine has the equivalent climate range or regime as you would find from northern Scandinavia into southern France. So tremendous difference in climate. And if we take a look at how Maine has changed over the instrumental era, which goes back roughly to about 1900, in the late 1800s and early 1900s, when the records were really beginning to appear, it was not uncommon for Penobscot Bay to freeze over. And there are phenomenal pictures of Model Ts being driven across Penobscot Bay. People actually managed to travel along the shore. They would move houses, a variety of things. The last time that happened significantly was about 1971. So Maine has experienced very visually obvious changes. And if you take a look at the data for the state as a whole, over the last roughly 120 years or so, temperatures have risen. There's a trend. There's a lot of variability, however, and we'll talk about this variability. But in general, the temperatures have risen about 3 degrees Fahrenheit, which is non-trivial. It's enough to change the growing season by at least 1 week, making it 1 week longer. And in Maine, growing season is not very long, so that's a very big deal. It's ended up in precipitation being increased by about 6 inches, which is also a very good thing for Maine. And if we take a look at how this has evolved, this is a map that shows you, well, in the upper left, you see the time series for temperature, and then lower down, you see how this temperature is distributed over the state, starting in 1904, going to 1966 and 2010. You can see that the most significant amount of warming has really happened in the coastal and near coastal areas. Certainly as you go north, there's some warming, certainly by 2010. And you can see that the transition in this particular visualization since 1966 to 2010 is much greater than what happened prior to that. So there are tons of observations about how, for Maine, the things that have changed. They have not changed as dramatically necessarily as other parts of the world, but they have necessarily changed. A one-week increase in the growing season, more heat waves, seasonal drought, changes in the timing of freeze and thaw, more ice and wind storms, and these are, of course, becoming even more intense now. Overall increase in storm intensities has been about a 7-inch increase in sea level since about 1900. Increases in runoff and flooding, which are very important because as we have more and more urbanization in a place like Maine, pave more of the towns, then the runoff problem after large and massive rainstorms becomes important. Reduced winter snow, unfortunately for some of us, and the northward spread of tremendous of different species of all sorts. And you might think to yourself, well, these invasive species, they come up because they come in our cars, they come with animals. Well, we're having a much greater change in invasive species because you can bring a creature from Florida up to Maine and they won't survive very long. But as the temperature obviously begins to rise, they will more. So how do you make better predictions from a place like Maine? There are two primary techniques, and I'll talk briefly about both of them. The first are predictions that are based on climate models. And with a climate model, you need very robust data, instrumental records that cover as much of the planet as you can. And people who do modeling, our institute does modeling, basically trust data that goes back to 1979. That's about the very best data set we have, 1979 to the present. There are still large areas for which there is very little understanding of temperature, precipitation, et cetera. And then once you have this data, then you begin to try to figure out what's the physics that makes moisture move from one place to another. In the case of most of the climate models, they are primarily forced by some amount of natural variability that's understood by looking at the earlier part of the record, and then they're also forced by greenhouse gas warming. And if you look in the diagram on the right, you see that as we go into the future, there's a spread of values, and the lower temperatures for the future are based on having less CO2 in the atmosphere, and the very high temperature is having more CO2 in the atmosphere. This gives you a really good trend for the future. The early models were very good at predicting what would happen by today. They basically got the trend right, but they actually didn't get the magnitude right. They underestimated what was happening. And they give you a really great global view, not a regional view or a local view, but a global view. And in all cases, these models assume that there's going to be a linear trend with very little variability, because all of these models are based on an understanding that, well, they do not take into account the fact that abrupt climate change can occur. The first modern example of it was not that long ago. So what do these models say? They tell us that by 2030 to 2050, and it's in these documents that I suggest that you can find from PDFs, that the temperature will rise another 3 degrees Fahrenheit, which means that by 2030 to 2050, we'll have at least as much temperature rise as we've had since 1900. They mean that the summers will get longer, winters will get shorter, and as we all know, Lyme tick will spread. When my wife and I moved to Maine in 2000, we came from New Hampshire. We were so excited to come to a state that didn't have any ticks or Lyme ticks in it. Obviously, that's changed now. By 2040 to 49, certainly the entire state will be prone to Lyme ticks and rather severe state of them as a consequence of warming. Today, when the temperature in the summer goes from 74 to 79 degrees Fahrenheit, just a 5-degree Fahrenheit change, the number of admissions to hospital as a consequence of heat exhaustion double. By 2030 to 2050, the number of days during which we experience temperatures more than 95 degrees Fahrenheit will triple. So all of a sudden, Maine will go from a place, as it's already starting to do, that doesn't require air conditioning, in which people are not used to it, in which the population is older and obviously more prone towards heat exhaustion, to a place in which this will change quite dramatically. In terms of precipitation, by roughly 2030 to 2050, we'll have, again, another 6 inches of increase in precipitation. Same thing that happened that took almost 120 years before that. And we'll also have a northward shift of the biomes. The boreal forests in Maine will presumably, by 2050, disappear, and we'll begin to see far more southern species. So those are the general linear warming predictions that are based on the models. Now, if you add into those modern analogs, and when I say modern, these analogs can actually come from quite a while ago, for example, abrupt climate change. But even if we just look at analogs for, let's say, the very cold days, the wet periods, we can begin to get a much better regional understanding of what's going on. We can begin to explain some of the variability that we know exists in natural climate and we know will exist in future climate and have a better understanding of what the impacts are. If we go to the Gulf of Maine, everybody knows that the Gulf of Maine is one of the fastest warming bodies of water on the planet. And everything demonstrates that ocean acidification in the Gulf of Maine and the rest of the planet will increase. This is critically important as a consequence of because most of our food will eventually come, or much of it will come from the ocean, has a tremendous impact on fisheries. And as these temperatures begin to rise, obviously we're seeing the lobster industry migrating from significantly farther south in Rhode Island right up to Stonington, which is probably the penultimate region for lobstering in the area. And when the temperatures get to about 68 degrees Fahrenheit, not throughout the entire summer, but for a significant enough number of days, the lobsters will sadly migrate even farther north, south would be much better. So lobsters are impacted not just by changes of temperature, but in this particular case, by human activity, by overfishing of cod, and those cod were eating all of the lobster larvae. So when the cod disappeared, the lobsters began to take over, and now, of course, the warming system and the acidification is. Blueberries are potentially going to be even more abundant in the future. What blueberries like are warm summers, and as the Gulf of Maine gets warmer, it'll transmit more warm air inland, and we'll also have more rain that goes onshore. Will Maine ever get drier? Well, the answer is yes. Maine did get dry several years ago during the El Nino. And if you take a look at the relationship between El Nino, which is a time basically when the Pacific begins to warm, when it has enough heat that it actually gives a heat off, the result for Maine during an El Nino year is to have drier and warmer conditions. And I was in western Maine during the last El Nino visiting, and there were people carrying water to their houses from the local stream. And the interesting thing about, or maybe not interesting thing about El Nino, is that it was extremely frequent. Instead of occurring once or twice in 10 years, during the 1990s, it occurred far more frequently. So one has to wonder, as warming continues, how many more El Ninos will we have? And although the general expectation for Maine is that it will be wetter in the future than it is now, there will be years when there will be significant drought. And if you take a look at Maine compared to the rest of the United States during an El Nino, El Ninos, in general, for most of the United States, bring wet conditions. For Maine, they bring dry conditions. What happens if we had another volcanic event? In 1991-92, we had the Pinatubo eruption, erupted tremendous amount of gas, sulfur gas, which shields incoming radiation and particles. The skies were red for several months. This typically, if it's a volcanic event of the size of Pinatubo, lasts about a year or two, and then it dissipates. It turns out that if you take a look at what happens during all over the world during volcanic events, for a place like northeastern United States, in general, it gets colder and drier. So we should expect some sort of an offset in the warming trend. And if we take a look at an idealized future between now and about 2040, 10 to 20 years out, which is a really important time, obviously, for us to be thinking about in terms of business, quality of life, all of the things that we care about. What's going to happen in 2100 is critically important, but it's much harder to get people engaged in thinking about that. There is no doubt at all that we will continue on a warming trend. However, just to quickly summarize, what will interrupt that warming trend will be a La Nina. And during La Ninas, when the Pacific is a little bit colder, it'll be wetter and cooler in a place like Maine. During volcanic eruptions, it'll probably be cooler and drier. And during El Niños, it'll tend to be warmer and drier. And then if we have a massive injection of methane into the atmosphere as a consequence of melting of permafrost, we'll have another dramatic shift, similar to what we had in 2007 to 2012. Superimposed on that, and it is the new norm, will be this tremendous instability in the shape of the jet stream, which brings along with it storminess, drought in some places, etc. So what are the climate change impacts for Maine and for the globe in general? I think you'll see, for those people who may not be thinking about this, that in fact climate change is perhaps the most important security issue of the 21st century. It impacts our health and resources dramatically. I gave a couple of examples. I can answer questions about that later. It impacts the economy because of the use of fuels and how we heat our homes. It has a dramatic impact on the frequency of catastrophes, as I've already mentioned, and it has tremendous geopolitical impacts. An entire new ocean is opening up. There are all sorts of discussions in the military about where borders are, how will search and rescue be undertaken as more and more vessels begin to go through, which resources will be depleted, what's going to happen to the local people. And if you go back to the Mesopotamian collapse example 4,200 years ago, modern-day Syria and Iraq, there are many of us who believe that the underpinning for the Arab Spring is a consequence of drought, the underpinning for unrest in the Somalian pirates is the fact that many of those people were farmers. And when the drought came, they had to do something different. So where does Maine fit in here? Maine is already impacted. It will continue to be impacted. Things won't be perfect in Maine, but I think, as you'll find out, we're pretty lucky where we live. Maine has natural resources in significant abundance. Our water will continue to come, perhaps more than usual. It won't necessarily come at the same time of year. It won't come in the form of snow. And other than El Nino events and volcanic events, we probably will have a significant amount of water. Our forests are the very best form of carbon capture that we have anywhere. And this state, Governor Mills wants us to go carbon neutral by 2040 or 2050. One of the reasons that we can do that is we have a tiny population with a giant forest. So when you begin to calculate the numbers, how much we emit and how much we can actually absorb, we're in very good shape. And our marine environment, although things might change in terms of lobsters, there are other fish out there and there are other possibilities for using the marine environment. For example, seaweed. We're now the second biggest exporters of seaweed in the United States. With any luck, legislation will become stricter again. People will understand that their health is being significantly impacted by pollution, in particular upwind from us. Acadia National Park, unfortunately, is the second most polluted national park in the United States. That's not because of anything that we do in Maine. It's because of those days when ground-level ozone comes off the East Coast, goes offshore, and goes into Acadia National Park. Like every other place on the planet, we have tremendous potential for solar power. The other thing that we have that many places don't is wind power, and wind power on land, but in particular wind power in the Gulf of Maine. Our university is heavily involved in trying to develop very sturdy wind power systems, and if in fact all of the offshore wind power that is proposed could be put in, the Gulf of Maine would generate the equivalent of 12 to 15 nuclear power plants of power. All of a sudden, everything changes in Maine. We become the Saudi Arabia of the United States. And we end up with energy independence in the process. Right now, we buy from mostly Canada for our energy, although it's relatively clean energy. It comes in the form of hydroelectric power. But with offshore wind power and more utilization of solar, even better. We are already beginning to become, particularly through Portland, the eastern United States, U.S. Arctic Gateway, where the equivalent of Alaska, except it's much easier to get into Maine than it is to Alaska. It's already changing the economy of Portland. Whoops, let me back up. Organic farming and the brewing industry are doing extremely well in Maine, and they will do even better if we have offshore wind power and relatively inexpensive energy. We have our soils are not the best in the world. Everybody obviously left Maine and New England after the Civil War, but now, of course, the Midwestern soils have been significantly depleted, and soils in New England have had a chance to regrow. With all of the proceeding, we have the possibility for a dramatically improved economy in Maine, more jobs. Along with that, I'm convinced that the population of Maine will double in the next 10 years. I guess the proof will come with the census, and that's it's bad in some ways, but it's also good. We certainly need more people working here in the service industry, and the bottom line is that whether we think it's good or bad, I think it's inevitable, and that means that we need to plan for changes. And towns like Saco, Maine, are already thinking about what will happen to their schools. I live in Brooklyn, Maine. We have 50 children in the school. The school is about the right size. If suddenly 30 more children came, which is not a lot of children, it could be with 10 families, all of a sudden everything changes. The whole tax base for the town changes. So it's important for us to think about these things for the future. And overall, I'm actually very optimistic about Maine. I think our quality of life will continue. We need a better way to get rid of the ticks, however. So what can we all do? And these are all very obvious things that I'm going to suggest, but I'll put them on here anyway. Obviously, we need to stay informed, all of us. Climate change is such an unbelievably multi and interdisciplinary and holistic undertaking. It impacts every single thing that we do and that we want to do for the future. And it's important for us to pay attention to it and tell people around us. Obviously, we need to get legislators on board. We're fortunate we have a governor, a fantastic new governor, who is thinking about these things. We need to put a lot of pressure on our legislators because legislation for clean air, legislation for tax benefits, all of these things work, and they provide tremendous opportunities. We need to be to support climate-friendly activities, and that can mean anything from standing with a sign to going out, and I know a lot of people in this area do this, to building wooden frames, putting plastic over them, and helping people who are not in as good a situation as we are to insulate their homes, and a variety of other things, and to adopt climate-friendly solutions. All of these obvious things, increased efficiency, reduce emissions, reduce waste, and reuse. So these are, under each one of these, it differs where you live, but these are things I think that are really important for us to think about. So I'm convinced that we're in the age of climate decision, and the things that we do are going to impact the course of civilization for the future and also the overall health of our planet. And one of the ways in which you can stay informed about air quality, stay informed about how climate is changing, is to visit our two websites from our institute. The one in the lower right is 10green.org. You only have to put in the name of a town or a zip code, and you can find out how polluted or not polluted it is where you live. You can also find out whether or not measurements are being taken about air quality. These are the 10 accepted EPA standard, basically air quality indicators, particles, greenhouse gases, toxic substances. And if in fact those measurements are not going on where you live or upwind from where you live, you might want to talk to the town or the local city or the state and say it's really important to be monitoring air quality. If you're trying to make a decision or your family's trying to make a decision about a good place to live, air quality is key. 7 million people a year die. 1 out of 10 people in the world die as a consequence of air quality. And if you want to understand where the jet stream pattern is today, why, in fact, eastern North America this winter or last winter was super cold, while, in fact, the rest of the northern hemisphere was warmer than ever, go to climatereanalyzer, one word, .org. We get about 3,000 to 5,000 hits a day, and the graphics are beautiful. And if you, for example, if you're a farmer and you know how your crop has changed over time, you can actually plug that data into this software and find out how climate is directly related to the commodity that you happen to be interested in. Thank you for taking the time to come, and I look forward to answering questions.
Thank you for what was a very, very informative and stimulating talk. I wanted to point out that on our website, under the announcements, we have already posted a link to the Coastal Maine Climate Future 2019, and we also have a link to the Climate Change Institute's website. So in addition to hunting for it on theirs, you can go directly to our website and do it from there. Wanted to point that out. And are we going to be able to post your slides on our website too? If you would. So we'll also post the slides so that you'll have a reference to the entire set. We're going to have a lot of questions, I'm quite sure. Let me ask, you didn't really talk about, are there things that we can do in the terms of international cooperation with the Canadians or with other northern countries or whatever, that will, you know, help us to plan or help us to take actions now that are important for this?
That's a great question. And having spent a lot of my career in the Antarctic, the fact that the Antarctic is an international territory has made it much, much easier, not just for scientists to go there, but for tourists to go there, and for the area to be protected. Probably the best protected fisheries in the world are in the Southern Ocean. Unfortunately, that analog isn't being used anywhere else in the world, and there was always a hope that it would be used on other planets, but that remains to be seen. So what we end up doing is becoming involved as a nation with large organizations. And for the Arctic, the former president of Iceland put together something that's called the Arctic Circle. And the Arctic Circle is an organization or a meeting that goes on in Reykjavik in Iceland every year. Hundreds of people go to it. And the fascinating thing is that it includes not only people from the Arctic nations, of which we're one, but people coming from other countries who understand that the Arctic is very important, who want to be able to say something. Some of it's because they want the resources. Some of it's because they want to protect it. And to Governor Mills' credit, this year I think we had 50 or 60 people from the state of Maine who went to the Arctic Circle meetings to begin to collaborate. Part of it is because there are economic benefits and opportunities. So venues like the Arctic Circle, the Paris Climate Accord obviously would have been a very good one for us to stay, to maintain our participation in. I think the fact that the White House is getting us out of the Paris Climate Accord actually had the opposite impact. I believe that many people thought that the Paris Climate Accord would be the beginning of actually solving the problem. And the answer is that it was the best step at that point. And the only way that they could get to an accord was to have each country come and suggest what they would be willing to do with no particular punishment if you don't. So it was a great forward step, but it wasn't the answer. And therefore, people who were highly encouraged that we had done this, that was great. But the fact that it's being taken away from us now has energized people. And I've seen, I lecture all over the world, and I've seen, and all over the country, and I've seen small groups popping up everywhere like crazy in the last few years, which is really encouraging. And getting our state and federal governments more heavily involved is critically important. We just had the Conference of the Parties, not we, but the United Nations just had the Conference of the Parties in Madrid. And that's a time when ideally the United States would have come and interacted with other countries. Since it's the White House policy not to do that, California went, Maine went, and states are beginning to do things independently. And in many ways, that's actually better because there are a lot of different ways of looking at climate change and many different impacts that differ depending on which state you're in. And once states are able to make one-to-one contact with other people at these conferences, we have a much better chance of having change. So there's no simple answer to your question.
If there were simple answers, it would put a good answer already.
Hopefully you had enough time to go through. You have the hardest job.
Well, I tell you.
You've got to figure out which questions fit together.
There's a whole lot of them here. Yeah. Here's one I found very interesting. It's a political question, if you're willing to wander into the political area. 50% of the population thinks that climate change is a hoax. What can we do, both from a scientific standpoint and a public standpoint, to try to change those views?
Well, okay, how do you change those views? Let me first talk about whether it's 50% or not. I've heard numbers that go all over the place. I've heard more like 70%. And I've also heard very interesting statistics in which a question was asked, do you believe scientists who say that climate change is real? And it's 90%. Yes, they do. Do you think that all scientists agree that climate change is an important problem? And that's where it goes back to 50-50. And that's because, as we know from the tobacco industry issues and the defense of the tobacco industry by skeptics, and by the way, some of the same skeptics who protected the tobacco industry are now skeptics against climate change. This is all based on not wanting legislation, not wanting control. So if you put enough money in, as the Heartland Institute has done, supported by the Koch brothers, if you put enough money in, you can turn the web from something which appears to be giving you very positive influence about climate change into something that provides just all you need is a speck of uncertainty for many people to begin to think that maybe the scientists don't agree. So, but to answer the question, what can you do? I think there are three things that we care about. One, of course, are our families and our close friends. The second thing that's universal, I believe, is health. And the third thing is our wealth. And the very fact that the entire issue about air quality and water quality, water quality has gotten much better in this country than it was 30 or 40 years ago, but it's still not perfect. We know there's lead in water, and not just in Flint, Michigan, but in many other places. Once people begin to realize that this is part and parcel of exactly the same issue, greenhouse gas rise, that's creating all of the physical changes to the climate system, there will be many more people who become energized. Because whether you only want to reduce lead in the atmosphere or toxic substances in the atmosphere and don't care about greenhouse gases or not, it doesn't matter. Because if you reduce toxic substances in the atmosphere, you'll reduce greenhouse gases in the process. So health and wealth. In Maine, most families spend about 10% of their salary on energy. Which is an immense amount of money. The average salary in Maine is not high. Through offshore wind power, which is a while off and will require a lot of money, but through use of solar panel fields, and by conserving better, by insulating homes, low-income people are able to save significant amounts of money, hundreds of dollars that can really make a very big difference in their lives. Health and wealth, number one. And the second part of that is understanding what the impacts are for the area or the location that you live in. If you live on the coast, certainly sea storms, sea level rise, these are things that are important. If you live significantly farther inland, it has much more to do with the local crops and forestry. And coming up with explanations that actually relate to people so that they realize that this is not just something that's going to happen by 2100, but these changes are happening right now.
Thank you very much. Here's one on kind of the technical part of it. I know you're a climate scientist, but do you see a future good effects from geoengineering, i.e. change systems to capture carbon and those type of things?
Yeah. Geoengineering, the best sort of geoengineering is earth engineering, obviously, carbon capture through vegetation. And interestingly enough, the countries that are accelerating fastest with this are China and India. But the human version of geoengineering, we've already tried some of it. Acid rain has been proposed as a way to reduce greenhouse gas warming. And in fact, between the 1940 and 1980, just before the Clean Air Act came in for acid rain, we actually, without realizing it, offset greenhouse gas warming, and then suddenly it accelerated once we cleaned up the atmosphere, which is a good thing, obviously. So putting sulfur into the atmosphere, it would cool things, but we would also lose our forests and kill all of the animals in the lakes and the rivers. So that's not a very good solution. People talk about clean coal. It doesn't exist. But even if it did exist, and even if you were able to capture that carbon emission and put it back in the ground, you'd have to do an awful lot of capture in the ground to get CO2 out of the air, number one. And in the process, you're acidifying groundwater and polluting groundwater. It's been suggested, because the natural system does this, that if you throw tons of iron into the ocean, it absorbs more CO2. And we know this happens. When the winds blow over desert regions, you can demonstrate this. When the actual experiment was run by having large freighters take iron out into the middle of the Pacific and dump it, yeah, it absorbed more CO2, but they used more CO2 actually transporting the iron to the sites where they dumped it. So, and putting large reflectors in the top of the atmosphere, well, we have a lot of satellites already. I mean, that would be a very complicated thing to do and highly unlikely. So it sounds as if I'm saying geoengineering is not good, but that's actually not what I'm saying. I'm saying everything that's been thought of so far has actually been done already. We need to be smart about it. I actually don't think there is we're not going to engineer ourselves out of the situation. However, I still think we ought to be putting money into research in geoengineering, because in the process, we'll learn important things. Maybe somebody will get lucky. I don't think so, but it's well worth trying it, because by attacking a giant problem like this, at the very least, we'll learn some other important things.
We had a large number of questions that were motivated by your comments on the Maine forests and the fact that the carbon capture from the Maine forests and the decrease in our forests caused by logging, the proposed CMP corridor, and whether that's something that's going to have a major impact on the forests and the... Mm-hmm. Could you comment on that general area?
It's true that in Maine we harvest a lot of the forests, and if those forests are harvested correctly so that they grow back, then the net result is that we continue to capture carbon. It would be very unfortunate to take a big chunk of this state and get rid of the forest and put pavement there, which is what's happened in many other places in the U.S. But we haven't done that yet, and we need to be smart enough not to do that, and we need to be smart enough to understand how the vegetation will change, because in addition to climate change, there are also impacts by pests, by forest fires. So we need to really protect the forests. And obviously, there will be industrial uses for it. But as long as it's done smartly, I don't see any reason why we can't continue to do this.
The same vein then on environmental concerns. Someone wants to know whether wind power versus the birds and bird strikes, because I know I lived in California and that was a major problem.
Yes, and that is, I agree.
Something we have to worry about?
Wind power is probably the biggest impact. Well, there are two impacts. One is seeing the turbines which some people don't enjoy, and the other are bird strikes, and if you put them offshore, whales and a variety of other marine organisms. Those are all important things. The cost for this offshore wind power will be immense. And I think if a small percentage of that, 1 or 2%, is dedicated to figuring out the best place to put this offshore wind power, the best way to deflect birds from flying in, that's the way we should be doing it. Right now, there are new radar systems that are being developed because as aircraft get close to a wind power, you actually can't see the aircraft in radar. So there are new radars that are being developed so that you can see where the aircraft are and alert the aircraft that they're getting close to wind turbines. If you can do that, I think it's very possible that you can create sounds and situations which deflect flocks of birds. Ideally, study which way the birds fly and put these wind power systems. The Gulf of Maine is a big place. It's not at all, and these wind turbines will not take up that much space. So try to create, put them in a place where the wind will continue and where there are the least, there's the least amount of migratory bird action. Study whales, find out where they go and create as well as one can safe systems. Nothing is perfect, but I think that renewable energy, wind power and solar power are about as perfect as we can get for energy. And if the wind stops, we're going to have a lot bigger problem than climate change. It means the Earth's no longer rotating.
Thank you. Here's someone wants you to speak about the tipping point that we're all hearing is going to happen sometime soon, after which everything is irreversible. Could you comment on
sure.
That concept?
This whole concept of tipping points actually comes from, to some degree, our discovery of abrupt climate change. The fact that you get to a certain point, and in truth, before you get to that point, you actually have a little bit of a signal in the climate system. This happened with the sea ice. You could see it trying to get smaller every year, and then it would come back again. Then it hits this abrupt climate change point, which is also some people call a tipping point, and it kicks into a new state, and then it tries to go back a little bit, but it stays in that state. So the term tipping point has become very popular as a sort of a for gloom and doom. Once you get to a certain point, it's the end. The answer for the Arctic is that the tipping point or the abrupt climate change that they experienced for the people who live in the Arctic and for the ecosystem there, it is a very big deal, and it has changed their lives. It's changed the way we live, too, with the jet stream, but not as dramatically. There will be many tipping points, many dramatic changes, and they'll have to do with the expansion of deserts, the fact that people will migrate out of them. There are 60 million, I think, people who were displaced as the consequence of the Middle East wars. The estimates for climate change refugees is well over 100-150 million people. There are all sorts of tipping points. And to suggest that there is some point in the climate system that we can approach in the next few years that's the end of the planet, I think it's an interesting thing to say. It makes a great science fiction movie. But if we think that way, then it basically takes the hope out of what we can do for the future. And I don't think it'll happen. However, for the South Pacific Islands, there are tipping points for them. There'll be a point at which they have to move. And many of the small South Pacific countries have already bought land in other countries where they'll move their country. So it's important to, in my opinion, to have people be activists and talk in a very extreme way because that helps to counter the other extreme. But we also have to think about what's realistic. And one of the things that we've tried to do with our predictions is come up with plausible scenarios, not a statement that says if you get to this, everything changes, but rather here are several situations that can occur. Keep these in the back of your mind when you're planning, and as you get closer and closer in time to the periods that you're trying to predict, it becomes clearer and clearer which subset of those are actually correct.
We have several dozen more questions here, and about, we're over by 2 minutes already. But let me ask a couple more, just because I think it's very, very interesting, and your comments are very useful for all of us. Someone comments, you noted that extreme climate change has occurred in the past in as few as 1 to 5 years. What causes those quick changes? I mean, why all of a sudden do things happen?
That's an excellent question. And the best that we know about abrupt climate change is, if it happens as it does in less than 1 to 5 years, it's got to be through some part of the Earth system that changes very easily. So that would be the atmosphere shifting, as in the case of the jet stream, or the extent of sea ice, which has already happened. Because sea ice is only 1 or 2 meters thick, it's easy enough to melt it. And you get a double whammy with sea ice once you remove the white surface. Incoming solar radiation is no longer as easily reflected. You now have a dark ocean that absorbs heat. Plus, you've opened up the container, the ice container that was over the ocean, and you get a lot more heat coming out. So those are the two things, along with some ocean circulation, those are the mechanisms by which abrupt climate change occurs. So what do you need to do that? We know that a rapid rise in CO2 does it. We ran the experiment, and it worked a few years ago, unfortunately. The other thing that can do it would be a whole bunch of volcanic events that occurred, either very large ones or several that occurred one after the other. It's not such a common thing for that to happen, but it did happen 72,000 years ago, and they were big enough volcanic events that they actually cooled the climate for 100 years, put the world into a temporary short-scale ice age. So the quick answer is anything that the natural climate operates as a consequence of, which would be greenhouse gases, volcanoes, and also changes in ozone. As it turns out, the reason that predictions of climate prior to this warming era have done fairly well was that they were dependent on the solar cycle. And the solar cycle, we now know there are times when there's more energy coming from the sun, and this tends to be about one every 10 to 12 years. During those times, it was assumed that there was actual heating that went on in the top of the atmosphere, and that's been proven by satellites, so that's not correct. However, what does happen is you change ozone in the upper atmosphere. And this is the good ozone. The bad ozone's down to the bottom. That's the stuff that we generate as a consequence of our own pollution. But in the upper atmosphere, between 15 and 25 kilometers up, if you take all of the ozone and compress it, 10 kilometers worth of ozone, and compress it, it would fit between my fingers. And yet that ozone is what protects us from incoming radiation. And that is that ozone that obviously disappears for 2 or 3 months over much of the Antarctic and the Southern Ocean. And it is directly a consequence of chlorofluorocarbons, which are very effective in destroying ozone. So, quick answer is massively accelerated rates of greenhouse gases, depletion of ozone or addition of ozone, and anything that simulates a volcanic event, like a lot of sulfur going into the atmosphere, these are all capable of creating abrupt climate change, particularly in the atmosphere and sea ice areas.
Well, I'd love to have a lot more time to quiz you some more, but I think we'll thank you with that.
Thank you.
Really appreciate it.
Thank you very much. And those are great, great questions.
There were a lot more great questions, too. Before we move, I'm going to give you a Midcoast Forum cup.
Thank you.
For your, when you're out there on the high seas, this will warm you.
Okay, wonderful. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you.
I get a lot of fine talks here.